Good afternoon. Thanks for staying with us. All right. My name is Marita Sommer. I'm presenting on behalf of Carrie Herbar. She's not able to be here today. I have no relationships to disclose. I will tell you a little bit about the National Association of Local Boards of Health to start. We work to promote and encourage good governance in public health. Health departments, 70% of them are run by a board, also go by the name of county commissioners, health councils. They're the advising, governing, or policymaking authorities for that community. Now into the presentation. As many of you know, there's been a great transformation in livestock farming in the past 30 to 40 years. Meat and dairy comes from large farms rather than small family-owned farms. Milk production has doubled, meat production tripled, egg production quadrupled since 1960, and it takes a lot less time to actually get that meat from a farm to your table. A little bit about some definitions. Animal feeding operations are a lot or facility where animals are kept or confined for 45 days or more per year. And crops, vegetation, or forage growth are not sustained over a normal growing period. Concentrated animal feeding operations are animal feeding operations that also have a certain number of animals or have animals that fall within a range that have the waste material that come into contact with water supplies. Manure is a major concern when dealing with CAFOs. They can also have plant nutrients, nitrogen, phosphorus, or also pathogens that are a production of those. Just with the large amount of waste that's produced, which can range from between 2,800 and 1.6 million tons per year, depending on the size of farm and the type of animal. Other potential effects include groundwater contamination that then can affect drinking water, surface water contamination, reduction in air quality, triggering asthma and some other respiratory illnesses, and greenhouse gas emissions. Additionally, there is a strong foul odor associated with many CAFOs. There's an increase in insect vectors. Pathogens, as I identified, antibiotic-resistant bacteria, and also a major decrease in property value when new CAFOs come into the areas. Right-to-farm laws have a lot to do with these CAFOs. They were originally created to address conflicts between farmers and their neighbors in order to protect the family farm from suburban sprawl and the nuisance complaints. So in many states, the way that law is written then is that the right-to-farm law overrides any sort of nuisance complaint laws. And agribusiness lobbied for and did achieve stricter right-to-farm laws in the 1990s. So looking at how boards of health are involved with CAFOs, boards of health are really the oversight authority for a community. They're charged with the three core functions of public health: that assessment, policy development, and assurance. And in order to achieve each of those as it relates to CAFOs, they can do several things. First, the board needs to work with community partners, the health department, other nonprofits, universities, to ensure that there's effective methods for collecting and tracking public complaints, as well as tracking and monitoring water quality and other environmental effects. A big part of that is ensuring that environmental staff exists in the community. There are also services that a lot of local health departments do provide to help ease frustrations with the CAFOs, including fly trapping, testing for water quality, and monitoring emergency room exposure rates. As it relates to policy development, boards often adopt health-based regulations about CAFOs that can go beyond what the state has regulated. Boards should be aware, though, that any regulations may result in lawsuits or threats to funding in the communities, as, you know, just with the petro-oil industry, they bring a lot of money to communities, and so do farms. And so understanding the state statutes and also how your community receives its funding is important when you look at any sort of environmental policy. But boards also have been known to work with other officials to institute regulations going through zoning ordinances. As far as assurance go, boards can advocate for better environmental practices. They can hold public meetings to receive complaints. I know several boards allow public comments at any of their regular scheduled monthly board meetings. They can collaborate with other agencies that have jurisdiction to regulate these farms. They can educate local agencies and public officials going to their state legislatures. They can request public hearings. And they can also work with agricultural and farm representatives to teach about better environmental practices and pollution reduction techniques. Looking at a few case studies, there's a Board of Health in Massachusetts that had a longstanding pig farm, and it was near a community, but then the pig farm received an additional hog finishing facility, and complaints started to really increase. There was a lot more waste. So what the health department did is they filed an order of prohibition against the farm. And of course the farm appealed the Board of Health, and so a grievance hearing was held. And the Board of Health heard months and months of testimony from community members, from the farm owners, and the board decided that they would do their own site assessment and able to really determine the appropriateness and what type of regulation should be held for this. So they're still working to complete their site assessment, but they do plan on drafting regulations one way or another. They did work with the farm while the site assessment is being completed to request advance notice before the manure is treated or applied to the soil, and they then make that information public. The farm did adopt a new manure management system, so already without formal regulation, just with community partnerships, you can see that some positive action being done there. The Board of Health also submitted a grant application, and that's quite common for boards to either partner with universities or submit grant applications in order to study these incidents. In Ohio, the Wood County Board of Health has two dairy farms, and both have proposed to expand to over 1,500 cows. There's also been an additional three farms proposed in the area. Community groups are very opposed to this, and the board has heard a lot about this at the meeting, at their regularly scheduled meetings. What the Wood County Board of Health did is they contacted other communities, other counties, to see how people in Ohio had been dealing with CAFOs. And as it turns out, no other boards in Ohio have opted to regulate these farms. So what the Wood County Board of Health decided to do was provide services to the community to show that they care and to help keep public health as a major concern and increase environmental health. And so they now offer free and low-cost water and well testing. They test area ditch and waterways for fecal coliform, bacteria, phosphorus, and nitrates. And they also purchase fly traps for the community in order to monitor and count the flies to determine if there's an increase in vectors. Wood County, Ohio has had issues with vector control in the past, so this is a very high priority for them. In Iowa, officials looked into regulating the CAFOs after the number of farms in Iowa began growing. Board of Health and the Board of Supervisors adopted a moratorium on new construction of farms, but the Farm Bureau came back and offered a lot of resistance and threatened a lawsuit, and so the County Board of Supervisors repealed the ordinance in June of 2005 because they don't have the resources to fight something like that. And so, again, this is Carrie's information. If you have simple questions, I might be able to answer them, but anything in depth, I'm going to have to pass along to her. Marita. Thank you.
I think we have about 5 minutes to take questions for our presenters. So if you have any questions, go ahead, please.
Ray, I was wondering, you're representing local boards of health. Do you have any idea how, which state agencies are overseeing these CAFOs?
I will pass that question along. If I can take your information at the end, I personally don't. This isn't my field.
Oh, okay.
I think it's natural resources.
Natural resources.
In those states? I mean, because it isn't in our state, it's the fox looking over the chicken coop in our state.
Understand.
Yeah, I know Carrie did a publication on this issue, and so I can definitely get you a copy of that as well that addresses that.
Just to answer your question, I think in California, there's probably a number of agencies that the CAFOs have to get permits from, so like whatever city or town is in charge of the land use for that jurisdiction, they probably have to get their district permits. And then probably permits from the water agency and maybe even like some department, agriculture board or something. At least in California, this would probably be a multiple agency permitting process.
In California, yeah.
it's our ag department that looks over it.
What city are you in?
I'm in the Department of Environmental Quality. But we don't do anything for water.
Yeah.
Go ahead. I had a question for the ladies from the Louisiana Bucket Brigade. I'm Erin. I'm from Tonawanda, New York, and we've used the bucket up there. Our community has about 50 air permit facilities in the 2-mile radius, so the bucket is our friend. what we've run into, we're fairly young, and I was really interested in your Labor Neighbor Conference. We have just beginning to. Most of the companies are actually represented by steelworkers, which is a good thing. And so we're beginning to broker agreements with the steelworkers. Unfortunately, now is a really good time to do that. There was an accident actually at our DuPont plant yesterday, and somebody passed away. So I think there's a lot of opportunity for collaboration and to build power between the two organizations. Because of course the residents were really concerned because there's a huge explosion, and then there's a whole worker safety issue. So I was just wondering if you guys could talk a little bit more about how that worked. So now, if you were there, what the experience was, how that happened.
So what happens is the industry really works kind of build a fence, no pun intended, between the workers and the residents, and pitch it as if one is against the other. But we knew when we were talking about the idea of refinery accidents that the steelworkers were going to have very important knowledge to transmit about how to prevent those. So we called all the locals together that represented the refineries in the state, presented the data to them, and invited them to be a part of the roundtable experience, which was actually quite valuable because every time the refineries started to talk about their track record, the steel workers could actually say, well, this is what actually happens inside the plant, and talk about it more from a management perspective or the lack of a preventative maintenance perspective. And so, ahead of that roundtable, we just asked, both the Fence Line Neighbors Network and the steel workers to sit together just so that they could understand that they have a common goal. And it wasn't hard at all. There was no friction whatsoever. Everyone got along, beautifully, and if we had the funds to do that every month, we really would.
Yes, go ahead.
Have you found a way to effectively communicate sampling data back to your community?
Yeah, I mean, we do an interpretation of the sampling data using sometimes we use body maps, sometimes we just print it out in a fact sheet and present that either in a community meeting or to the community group who then takes it back to the larger community.
This is Dan. Yeah. Your monitor, how high was your monitor? Did you account for the weight of the gases, the chemicals, their weight, and did you do it at different
levels? What I did
weather?
Was I sampled at what's considered to be is it about 5 feet in elevation, which is the breathing zone of when you're standing up approximately for most people.
Yeah.
So thinking in terms of like principles of occupational health monitoring, if you had a really dense gas release, I wasn't trying to measure like accidentally, we said trying to long term average exposure. So that's what it was. It was about 5 feet.
One more question, please. Yes.
I have, this is directed to Deanne and to Autumn. And I was just wondering, have you all presented your research to Louisiana lawmakers? And what is your general experience if you've done so?
I haven't presented this research to Louisiana lawmakers. I testified to a House committee this summer about another issue, and I don't think it did a damn thing, because I think they all had their mind made up, probably were going to vote anyway, but I think it served the purpose of the media's there, and other people are there to get out the message, but I don't know. What about your experience?
So this data has been presented in the Shreveport area to local politicians there. The St. Bernard area, what we're trying to work on is through the LEPC, the Emergency Planning Commission, there, and try to get them to recognize these as chemical emergencies, and to, one, get involved in preventing these accidents, and two, get involved in informing residents when the accidents happen. Because often what happens is something happens at the plant and no one has any idea what has, you know, they only know from the sound or the explosion or the flaring that something's gone wrong, but they don't know what was released, the health effects of what was released, and its, you know, chemical dynamics in the environment. So we're really trying to work with the Emergency Planning Commission to do that well. You know, there's a plan to take this to the state legislature. Once we figure out, you know, our campaign for the fees.
So this officially concludes this session, but please feel free to mingle with our presenters and ask more questions based on the time we have left. Thank you very much.